Hi, everybody, and welcome to Context Countdown. I'm Andrew Krupko, and I'll be going over five recent news stories that need to be placed in context. Some of them are misleading, while others are spot on, but either way, there's a context behind them, and I'm here to tell you what's really going on. Let's take a look at our top five countdown for the week. At number five, we have Trump unveiling another travel ban. Once again, there's a heap of uproar over Trump's new revision to his trademark travel ban, which this time includes country-specific requirements and rulings as a legal workaround, which attempts to avoid the measure being struck down by liberal progressive judges. That's not what's attracting the most attention, however, since it's the inclusion of North Korea and Venezuela, which has a lot of people talking. Chad was also added to the list, while Sudan was silently taken off and Iraq had its exemption extended because of its anti-terrorist cooperation with the US. But the expansion of the president's restrictive measures to North Korea and Venezuela means that the overall initiative no longer has the optics of being a so-called Muslim ban. For all intents and purposes, it never was, as it was more of a politicized instrument for punishing the US's adversaries such as Iran and rewarding its partners like the Saudis. Even though any sincere move aimed at stopping terrorist infiltration into the US would have reversed their roles by banning the Saudis and permitting the Iranians. Even so, Trump feels that he scored a symbolic victory by adding non-Muslim countries to the list. Though this too is more about imagery than substance. The political leaders of North Korea and Venezuela, as well as their immediate family members, rarely travel to the US for obvious political reasons. So the ban isn't really going to change anything in a practical sense. What it did do, though, was re-erupt the controversy over whether Trump has the right to do any of this in the first place. As politically incorrect as it may sound, any country should have the sovereign right to restrict the migration of foreigners to its soil, no matter what the reason may be. This isn't an endorsement of Trump's policy, nor a refutation of it either. All countries pursue their own interests, and they use a variety of means, including unsavory ones like blanket and discriminatory bans to advance them. Moreover, nobody anywhere in the world has a right to travel anywhere else outside of their home country. It's a privilege to be allowed into another country, not something which should be taken for granted, as it often is in today's globalized world. To put the shoe on the other foot, each of the targeted states has the same sovereign prerogative as the US does to ban Americans from their country if they wanted to. And it wouldn't be surprising if a few of them flex their muscles in the coming days to do so, if even only for symbolic reasons. The next one up is Ukraine passing a bill that it claims is for education language reform in banning schools from teaching in minority languages at all levels by 2020. The move has proven extremely controversial, triggering a program from the Russian, Hungarian, and Romanian governments, with Russian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Maria Zakharova even slamming it as linguistic genocide at the state level. She has a point, too, because nearly 10% of school children are being taught in one of the country's minority languages, and the forced Ukrainianization by the Kiev authorities might prove troublesome for students who aren't as fluent in the national language as their ethnic Ukrainian peers. Supporters of the initiative claim that Ukraine, as a sovereign state, has the right to implement any law that it wants. But the caveat that critics point to is that the country already has approximately 2.5 decades worth of precedent in allowing minorities to be educated in their native languages. Therein lays the crux of the issue, because had post-independent Ukraine never allowed this, then it's doubtful that around 1/10 of its school children would be affected at this point in time. However, some wise voices in Kiev at the time had argued that minority language privileges were a necessary compromise in order to keep the geographically artificial state together in the tumultuous aftermath of the Soviet dissolution. In the present day, however, less pragmatic and more nationalistically inclined individuals in Ukraine are taking the short-term, knee-jerk reaction that this long-standing legislation somehow endangers national unity instead of strengthening it, which is why they decided to repeal it. This is incredibly ironic, because Ukraine is inadvertently destabilizing its periphery and diminishing the appeal of so-called Ukrainian patriotism while trying to do the opposite. What's meant by this is that the leading Russian, Hungarian, and Ukrainian minorities in the country, as well as their Polish, Slovak, and Tatar counterparts, are even less likely to feel as stakeholders in the post-coup Ukraine than they do now, which is to say that they're not going to care too much about the state's success. This does not infer that they'll try to separate from it or sabotage it, but just that Kyiv is continuing to fail its citizens and abrogate the rights of its many minorities in order to please a nationalist majority. Considering how the governments of two EU members, Hungary and Romania, have already complained very loudly about this, Ukraine's latest move will only contribute to it being further ostracized from Europe like the black sheep that it's become, being useful only for cheap labor and geostrategic military purposes, but useless when it comes to upholding the West's sociocultural values. Third in our countdown is another Russiagate scandal on Facebook. The story goes that some Russian-based individuals allegedly spent roughly $100,000 to purchase 3,000 political ads on Facebook, which is a measly sum in both cost and output, in order to influence the 2016 elections. According to the mainstream media, these ads were conservative in nature, but their exact contents have yet to be made known to the public, though Facebook will be sharing the relevant information with Congress. Reuters reported that Facebook will be implementing a new rule in response to all of this, mandating that political advertisers disclose who's paying for ads on the social media platform, as there's already a law stipulating this for TV. All conspiratorial details aside, the bigger picture here is that people are discussing the potential influence that social media can have in altering people's perceptions, particularly as it relates to elections, though this in and of itself is nothing new. In fact, the so-called Arab Spring, which is really just a theater-wide color revolution attempt, is universally credited with gaining the inertia that it did precisely because of Facebook and other social media platforms. And it's long been established that the US played a determining role in guiding events during that time. It's perhaps for that reason why its intelligence agencies are so overly sensitive about this supposed Russian influence operation. Though if one takes the time to soberly assess what's being alleged, it becomes more and more doubtful that there ever was a conspiracy to begin with. For starters, it's highly unlikely that Russian intelligence agents, stereotypically known for their operational finesse and cunning, would be so clumsy as to leave behind an obvious paper trail leading back to their homeland. Moreover, a paltry $100,000 on only 3,000 ads doesn't add up to much influencing, and it's an insult to voters' intelligence to believe that they'd be brainwashed by a single advertisement that they probably just scroll through anyhow and pay no attention to. If anything, and should any indisputable Russia link be proven throughout the course of the investigation, then it can't be ruled out that this was an independent initiative by political activists, which might make it a bit unethical, but not illegal at all. Actually, seeing as how Facebook admitted to having a loophole allowing foreigners to pay for political ads in target countries, it can't be ruled out that US-based forces, whether the CIA or independent political activists, could have also influenced other countries' elections in the same way that their Russian-based counterparts are being accused of. The only difference, though, is that nobody would ever know about it, because Facebook has essentially turned into an extension of the American deep state and wouldn't ever bite the hand that feeds it by spilling the beans on any of their operations. Our runner-up is the Cambodian opposition urging the government to release their jailed leader. Opposition leader Kem Sokha's arrest in early September was due to leaked recordings from 2013, which alleged that he was cooperating with US experts in a bid to seize power. The government says that he was fomenting a color revolution, while his supporters say that it's normal in today's world for political parties to seek a broad array of international advisory support before elections. It's not clear whether the experts that Sokha was meeting with were intelligence agents or not, but any forthcoming information about these mysterious individuals' intentions, the quality of their so-called advice, and their effective capabilities will help shed light on what was really going on. In any case, the scandalous arrest has thrown the Cambodian National Rescue Party opposition into disorder, because the law stipulates that no political party can be led by anyone who's facing criminal charges, which means that they must either appoint someone else to take over the group or risk getting shut down and barred from participating in next year's elections, which some observers predict might be neck and neck. It's for this reason why the opposition and their international supporters have accused long-running Cambodian leader Hun Sen of framing Soka in order to destroy the opposition and ensure the continuation of his rule. As it always is whenever the U.S. is implicated in a regime change plot, the matter isn't as black and white as Washington and his partners are trying to portray it as. All domestic political factors aside, Cambodia is very strategically important nowadays because of its geographic location and relationship with China. President Hun Sen is one of Beijing's closest partners, both in the diplomatic sense in terms of vetoing any hostile anti-Chinese motions by ASEAN, and also in the economic one when it comes to Beijing's One Belt, One Road global vision of New Silk Road connectivity via forthcoming overland rail transit through Laos and current maritime accessibility through the Gulf of Thailand. From an American zero-sum perspective, Cambodia is seen as China's Trojan horse in Southeast Asia, and this is why President Hun Sen is being targeted for removal. That said, the U.S. is cautious about how much pressure it puts on him because it doesn't want to instigate a regional crisis, at least not yet at this point. Cambodia is also slated to play a crucial role in the joint Indo-Japanese-Asia-Africa Growth Corridor, also known as the Freedom Corridor, because it's a transit state along the southern and southern coastal corridors between Myanmar's Japanese-invested Special Economic Zone port of Da Wei in the Bay of Bengal and southern Vietnamese ports along the South China Sea. Although there is also a central corridor connectivity route being planned, they would have to pass through the northeast Thai region of Isan, which might become a hotbed of the Red Shirts' anti-junta unrest in the future. Cambodia is therefore a safe bet for ensuring the strategic security of the Indo-Japanese initiative across mainland ASEAN, but only if they were confident that China couldn't leverage its clout over President Hun Sen to influence their transport corridors, hence why they want him out. However, one interesting fact to keep in mind is that the opposition is more nationalist than the ruling party, and it has a long history of rallying its supporters against what it says is the government selling out their country's interest to its neighbors. What this means is that the Cambodian National Rescue Party might inadvertently pose more of a strategic risk to the Freedom Corridor than President Hun Sen ever could, especially if it catalyzes a chain reaction of regional destabilization by trying to violently seize power in a color revolution coup. At our top spot, we've got Bangladesh imploring the UN last week to set up a so-called safe zone in Myanmar. The Bangladeshi Prime Minister claimed that this would ease the burden that her country is experiencing after hosting such a rapid influx of refugees, but it would, in all actuality, exacerbate the crisis by carving a South Asian Kosovo of Rohingya land out of Myanmar, just as I warned in a summer 2015 analysis on this topic. Her proposal was met with lukewarm support because of the far-reaching military implications that it obviously alludes to, but it nevertheless set the precedent for seriously considering this option sometime in the future if the scenario evolves to that point. If ever implemented, then this would be undertaken not just for the publicly plausible pretext of returning the Rohingya back to Myanmar, but to disrupt, influence, and ultimately seize control of China's New Silk Road oil, gas, and potentially one day even future rail corridors through Rakhine State. I already discussed this in a previous broadcast and also in several articles, so there's no need for me to elaborate any further on this tangent. What I'd like to talk about, however, is the dangerous internationalization of safe zone talk in South Asia, as this could either invite Indian military involvement or even potentially boomerang back into its restive northeastern provinces. About the first possibility, a mass grave of Hindus was found over the weekend, and the BBC, interestingly, quoted Rohingya Muslim refugees who said that the so-called Arakan Rohingya Salvation Army, or ARSA, which is designated as a terrorist group by Myanmar, was responsible for the killings. If true, then this would add credence to the claims that ARSA is indeed a radical Islamic terrorist organization, and whether it originally started out as such or evolved into it would be a moot point by that time. Unlike in the past, contemporary India is run by jingoistic Hindu nationalists, might sense what they could believe to be a golden opportunity to show off their nation's military prowess by taking the lead in waging what would be marketed as a hybrid mission, focusing on anti-terrorism and humanitarian intervention. It doesn't mean that this will happen tomorrow, or even if at all, let alone that it would succeed if commenced, but just that the Hindu victimization factor can't be discounted when analyzing India's foreign policy nowadays. However, it's precisely for that reason why Bangladesh's safe zone talk could boomerang around and inadvertently contribute to the further destabilization of India's northeastern provinces. This somewhat forsaken corner of the country is already awash with large numbers of Muslim Bangladeshi migrants, some of whom came to India as refugees around the time of the 1971 war, and India's Hindutva government wants most of them to leave. The forthcoming highly publicized campaign, which aims to kick India's Rohingyas out, is also meant to send a strong signal to the Muslim Bangladeshis who have been in the country for much longer. Though the unintended consequence might be that Bangladesh, which is already attracting a large amount of international sympathy to both itself and the plight of its very closely related and fellow Muslim Rohingya people, could leverage its newfound soft power to draw attention to the human rights situation of its Indian-based migrant community. That's not to say that either side will try to implement safe zones against the other, but just that the political fallout of a globally publicized refugee migrant spat between pro-American India ally and its neighborhood subordinate could further unsettle the situation in India's northeastern provinces and create strategic openings for China to regain some of its influence in Bangladesh. All right, folks, so there you have it. This wraps up this week's edition of Context Countdown, and as I always do, I want to warmly thank each and every one of you for tuning into my program. Hope you listen again next week, and have a nice weekend. Thanks. Bye.